Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In today's show, we're going to take a close look at fascism. We'll discuss its origins, its tenets, and its manifestation in different countries. But first, let's take a look at recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world and see how these events affect global stability and U.S. national security. Over the past couple of years, we've been covering the growing confrontation between NATO and Russia in Eastern Europe. Last month, for example, we discussed Russia's buzzing of a U.S. naval vessel in the Baltic. Recently, Russia created three new divisions to counter NATO in Eastern Europe. Marchand, will these three new Russian divisions substantially change the military balance in Europe?
I think we have to consider the fact that part of this is a propaganda move. I mean, Russia's armed forces are rather immense to begin with. But this does emphasize that Putin is increasing the size of his military. So I think what's important is that he's moving these three new divisions to the border with Eastern Europe, which means that as opposed to before, it would take him 48 hours to mobilize 400,000 troops. He's going to have three new divisions present directly on the border to counter NATO's forces. But I think even more so than that, I think this is indicative of Putin's move towards a professional army. Because one of the things that the Russian Ministry of Defense had mentioned, and even Putin himself had mentioned, was that he wanted to move away from Russia's traditional conscript army and move towards a professional army.
And of course, these new divisions are part of a readiness program that Putin has been pursuing for some time. The Russians have held these very large snap drills near its border in anticipation of a possible war with NATO. And according to the U.S. Navy, since the fall of 2014, Russia has increased by 50% its submarine patrols in waters off the coast of Scandinavia and Scotland, as well as in the Mediterranean Sea and in the North Atlantic. Russia's latest moves are in response to some pretty bold moves by NATO. NATO is deploying 4,000 additional troops to Poland and the Baltic. The NATO training exercises in Eastern Europe, which we've been covering for the last couple of years, continue. For example, this spring, 1,500 NATO troops will join in training exercises in Estonia. The United States recently sent two F-22 fighters to Romania to demonstrate NATO's strength in the Black Sea. And as we've often mentioned, there's been a substantial expansion of NATO since the end of the Cold War, which has taken NATO from 14 to 28 countries virtually encircling Russia, and its members include former republics of the Soviet Union, as well as members of the Warsaw Pact. Meanwhile, Marchand, I'm wondering, what is the attitude of our European allies to the growing tension in Eastern Europe? I've read that recently only 31% of Germans in a poll said that they would support German troops defending Poland and the Baltic states.
I think that's really indicative of much of the European mentality. When you look at France, for example, a substantial number of French citizens support the lifting of sanctions on Russia. In addition to that, the National Front, which is a French nationalist party, a right-wing party, is in favor of having good relations with Russia. In addition to that, there's a lot of sympathy in the United Kingdom for keeping out of Russia's affairs. And certainly the UK Independence Party has a strong stance of non-confrontationalism with Russia. So the trend in Europe is a move away from confrontation with Russia. Part of the reason, though, and the reason why you only have 31% of Germans supporting defending Poland and the Baltic states is because the Germans remember the last time they fought the Russians. For Germany, World War II is not all that long ago. And there are people alive today in their late 60s who were children during World War II, when the Russians leveled Berlin. It's very omnipresent in the minds of German citizens, and indeed the minds of citizens of the rest of Europe. Russian tanks have been in Berlin before, they've been in Bucharest before, they've been in Budapest before, and they've been in Prague before. So these countries are very weary of rushing to the defense of the Baltic states and Poland and Ukraine.
Would the Poles and the Baltic states be able to supply enough manpower without Russians to assist the United States in resisting an invasion of Eastern Europe by Russia?
Not as such. The part of the problem is that our strategy relies very heavily on the armed forces of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland. And in fact, there was an article in Newsweek which said that it would take the Russians between 48 and 72 hours to occupy all of the Baltic states. That is actually a fairly conservative estimate. In reality, it might be even quicker, just because their armies are very, very small. The Russian army is a behemoth. The Russians were able to mobilize within 48 hours approximately 400,000 troops. That's just sheer numbers. Part of what we also have to remember, too, in addition to the armies of Eastern Europe not being very formidable and being very small, Eastern Europe is flat. Largely, it's flat until you get to, like, the Carpathian Mountains in Romania. It is largely flat. It is tank country. And that's been Poland's greatest weakness in terms of defense, and certainly the greatest weakness of the Baltic states. If we look back to the German invasion of Poland and the Soviet invasion as well, let's not forget the Soviets invaded at the same time. One of the reasons why both the Soviets and the Germans were able to occupy Poland so quickly is that Poland is basically a flat country, and it's perfect for tanks. And the problem is the Polish army doesn't have a significant number of tanks, I mean, relative to the size of the invading Soviet and German armies. And we see that exact same problem today. We do not have the tank divisions in Eastern Europe that we did during the Cold War. In fact, we decommissioned most of our armored divisions. So looking at it from that perspective, really leaning on the Poles and the Baltic states, while they may have tremendous amount of fighting spirit, and I don't doubt their fighting spirit in the least, I really don't think they would be able for any more than 48 to 72 hours hold off the Russians.
And meanwhile, our policy against Russia has been driving Russia into the arms of its once adversary, China. Recently, the Russian foreign minister met with his Chinese counterpart and issued a statement of support for China, asserting that outside parties, i.e. the United States, should not interfere in the South China Sea dispute. China claims most of the South China Sea. Its claim is challenged by other countries in the region, including U.S. ally the Philippines, to whom the U.S. has increased military aid. In addition, the Russians are supporting China's opposition to U.S. deployment of an anti-missile system in South Korea. So although China and Russia were bitter rivals during the Cold War, under Putin, Chinese-Russian relations have greatly improved, and Russia has become a leading supplier of high-tech weaponry and resources such as oil and gas to China, while China has become a major source of capital investment for projects in Russia. Is this a strategic alliance which is going to threaten U.S. interests ultimately in the Pacific?
Absolutely. I really think that this is a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Russia and China had been bitter rivals during the Cold War. But now, while the two countries are ideologically very different, Putin is much more of a right-wing nationalist, and the Chinese are still ardent communists. In fact, very recently, the premier of China had stated that the Chinese must stick hard to their communist ideals and maintain their atheism. So these are two societies which are not like each other, but their mutual enemies, the United States.
And concerning China's military capabilities, we should note that China recently tested a new hypersonic weapon called the DFCF. Marshawn, could you please talk about this weapon's capabilities and how it might affect the balance of power in the Pacific?
The idea of the hypersonic missile is it's supposed to be a missile that goes into the upper atmosphere, travels at tremendous speeds, and then drops back down again. Unlike a conventional ballistic missile, which travels significantly slower, these are designed mostly for point targets, as opposed to, let's say, we're going to knock out a whole city. This missile, traveling at tremendous speed, can pick out an aircraft carrier, let's say, sitting off the coast of LA. The idea being that the Chinese, in theory, could launch this missile from a very, very significant standoff distance and knock out our aircraft carriers, because that's really what these missiles have been designed for, from what I have read, to knock out our aircraft carriers. Because our main naval strategy, in the Pacific relies on the carrier battle groups. Without our aircraft carriers, we lack the ability to bring in that close air support. Now, the Chinese and the Russians both viewed the aircraft carrier as more or less anachronistic, you know, something of World War II, because you have bombers now that can fly from China to the United States. But the fact is that the aircraft carrier does allow you to bring in close air support directly into the fight, whether we're talking about fighting in the South China Sea, or if we were to be fighting the Marshall Islands or the Philippines or somewhere like that, knock out our aircraft carriers. And now you also hinder our ability to transport troops and equipment into the region as well. So this hypersonic missile seems to be directed not at striking our cities, which have been the traditional targets of ballistic missile systems, but rather this weapon system seems to be designed to strike directly at our aircraft carriers.
And meanwhile, the Russians also have their own hypersonic weapon. The Russian Navy anticipates putting something called the Zircon anti-ship missile into production in 2018, which will have speeds of from 3,800 to 4,600 miles per hour. And that compares to the new Chinese weapon, which can travel at speeds between 4,000 and 7,000 miles per hour. So the Russians are moving ahead in this technology, while the United States hopes to have such a weapon by the 2020s. It's also interesting that the Chinese move and the Russian moves are launching what could be a new arms race as the Pentagon seeks to triple the number of U.S. attack submarines, which to a cost of $8.1 billion. And Marshawn, speaking of weaponry, a new weaponry, the Pentagon recently announced that it will buy 13 F-35 fighters for about $100 million a plane. Lockheed originally told the government that the planes would cost about one-third this amount. Is the F-35 worth buying at any price?
Unequivocally, no. It is not worth buying at any price. It's had a host of technical issues. The Chinese and the Russians are looking forward. They're saying, what's the future of modern warfare? Instead of taking the old strategies of warfare and saying, well, how can we make it better? They're looking forward. What's the new strategy? The new strategy is submarines. The new strategy, which the Russians have been very heavily investing in, let's not forget the Bore-class submarine. And then in addition to that, the hypersonic missile, looking forward beyond U.S. military capabilities, figuring out how to circumvent it. Whereas on the other hand, what we're investing in, the fighter-bomber system, is something that we really gave up on during the Vietnam War because it was considered highly impractical, and they got shot down a lot.
Some say the F-35 is too slow to be a fighter and too small to be a bomber.
That was the issue we had with the fighter bombers used during the Vietnam War. We experienced the same issue. They couldn't carry a large enough payload to be an effective bomber, but they were too slow. That's why they kept getting shot down all the time. And that's why the U.S. Air Force moved away from the fighter bomber, because they felt that it was impractical. Now, instead of looking towards the future of modern warfare, we're revisiting a same failed concept from the Vietnam era. The F-35 was first revealed in 2011. And has not been combat capable since. But the moment we unveiled the F-35, the Russians and the Chinese immediately developed counters to the F-35.
Excuse me, Marshawn, as an example of the kind of problems the F-35 has, its cannons, which can fire 3,300 rounds per minute, fine, but a 2014 report said that it could only carry 180 rounds. So according to my calculations, it could fire these cannons for only 5 or 6 seconds before running out of ammo.
The idea of the F-35 is this is supposed to be your all-purpose aircraft, capable of dogfighting as well as bringing in close air support and launching surgical strikes, because it's supposed to be stealth. Not only is this not possible, because every report I've read said that it is incapable of performing either the fighter role or the bomber role, but in addition to that, it has been on the drawing boards for so long and public knowledge for so long without being combat capable that it is entirely possible that the Russians and the Chinese have already developed their countermeasures. Not only have they developed aircraft designed to fight the F-35, but in addition to that, there's been speculation that the new Russian S-400 surface-to-air missile system can actually shoot it down already, which makes the aircraft redundant before it's even become combat capable.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking about the confrontation with Russia in Eastern Europe and the confrontation with China in the Pacific. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1. Marshawn, I'd like to turn now to the Mideast. Recently, Secretary of State Kerry said that Assad, the leader of Syria, must start a transition from power by August the 1st of this year. I'm wondering, Marshawn, what can the United States do if Assad does not comply with this ultimatum from the United States?
I think the United States will do the same thing that it did when we drew the red line and said that if Assad uses chemical weapons, we will launch airstrikes. We will do absolutely nothing. Because now, not only are we in a worse position than we were at the time the red line was drawn, if he decides not to transition, how are we going to make him transition? He has a Russian army behind him. And this isn't a couple hundred special forces on the ground. I actually read a phenomenal piece from CNN, actually, and they were CNN crew was visiting Palmyra for the concert. Now, the Palmyra was just captured from ISIS by the Russians. And they held a concert there for Palmyra's Russian National Orchestra. And what was really fascinating was the CNN reporters were talking about how they were passing whole Russian companies and tank divisions. And I mean, they were passing significant number of Russian troops. And they said what was mind-boggling was here was buses full of reporters being brought through a war zone by the Russian army, which is a logistical nightmare as well as a security nightmare. And they had Russian, not Syrian, Russian Mi-35 attack helicopters flying overhead at all times while the journalists were traveling on a six-hour drive from Damascus to Palmyra. In addition to that, they were constantly passing Russian troops, Russian tanks, and Russian armored vehicles. This means that the Russian commitment is not a few hundred Spetsnaz in Syria. This is a significant Russian army. Well, what does this mean for Kerry's threat? It means that Kerry's threat is completely impotent unless he wants to risk killing Russians. Because if we were to try to launch airstrikes to topple Assad, chances are we're going to kill significant numbers of Russians. And in addition to that, we run the risk of the fact that the Syrians and the Russians might shoot back because the Russians have deployed S-300 surface-to-air missile systems into Syria, which means they might start shooting at our aircraft. And the Russians have made it known that if we attempt to bomb Assad's forces, they will engage our aircraft. And the Russians do have an air force there.
It seems this idea of a no-fly zone, which was floated earlier in the presidential campaign this year, is off the table. Is that right?
Not unless we want war with the Russians. I mean, and that's, I know it sounds kind of colorful, but it's very true. The only way a no-fly zone would be practical is if we were willing to shoot down the Russian aircraft. Because at the end of the day, we can impose a no-fly zone and tell the Syrian Air Force you're not flying. But if the Russians decide we're flying anyway, and if you want to stop us, you can shoot at us, really, is that a gamble we're willing to take? And I don't think so. Militarily right now, General Mark Milley, who's the chief of staff for the Army, said unequivocally that the U.S. is not capable, said this before the Senate Armed Services Committee, that the U.S. is not capable of fighting what he termed a superpower struggle, which would be a war with Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea. Hillary's talked about a no-fly zone. Her and what army?
Before this uprising began in Syria, Syria, of course, was an important ally of Russia in the Mideast. And it seems like that's the way it's going to be after this fighting finally ends. So is that the likeliest scenario?
Absolutely. If we were pragmatic, if this administration were pragmatic, what they would do is they would reach out to the Russians and they'd say, listen, we are going to have a new Sykes-Picot Treaty. You can have influence in Syria, Lebanon, Iran. We will take influence in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, the Gulf states. And in addition to that, you defeat ISIS in Syria. We will take care of ISIS in Iraq. The Russian involvement in the Middle East is a fact. A Russian Syria is a fact. We can fight it. We can try to stall it as long as we want, but it is a fact. So instead of fighting it, let's use it to create stability in the Middle East. It's the same thing we did at the end of World War II with Eastern Europe. We don't have to like the Russians, but we can cut a deal with them. We can do business with Putin. Right now, China is very difficult to do business with, but we can do business with Putin. And if we're willing to give him a slice of the pie, a slice of the Middle East, we can take our slice. We can keep our influence. But unless we're willing to risk war, that's the only way we're going to make any gains. It's the only way we're going to at least keep what we have in the Middle East is if we're willing to accept that there will be a pro-Russian Syria, and that's a fact.
And speaking of Iraq, unfortunately, another U.S. soldier was recently killed in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. now has about 5,000 troops in Iraq to help the Iraqi government fight ISIS. And in the northern part of Iraq, where most of the action seems to be at the moment, the United States is working with the Kurdish militia, supporting them with advisors and with airstrikes. Do you think this combination will be enough to retake, for example, the major city of Mosul from ISIS?
No, it will not be effective. And part of the reason this will not be effective is, unlike in Syria, where the Syrian army was prior to the civil war, very capable. The Iraqi army has never really been very capable. The people who've been holding on to the country have been Shiite militias who were fighting the United States just prior to the rise of ISIS. And then in addition to that also, we're working with the Kurds, which is wonderful, but we have a very bipolar relationship with the Kurds. Because on the one hand, we'll arm the Kurds, we'll train the Kurds, but then the Turks, who are also our allies, members of NATO, will go and bomb the Kurds in northern Iraq. The Turks have had military advisors operating with Turkic and Sunni tribes in the north of Iraq, which was something I was shocked to find out. We're helping and we're hindering at the same time. It's a very bizarre relationship. Whereas the Russians have a very sort of single-minded focus. Keep Assad in power, work with anybody who's anti-ISIS and pro-Assad. That's it. You know, they'll work with the Kurds. So long as the Kurds are pro-Assad or willing to accept Assad, they'll work with the Kurds. So it's very focused, and that's one of the reasons why they've been successful, in addition to the fact that they have thousands of boots on the ground. The issue we're seeing in Iraq, and the reason why our strategy hasn't been successful, is we're relying on a very incapable Iraqi army, and at the same time we're relying on a Kurdish army, the Peshmerga, which is not only fighting ISIS, but which is also being bombed relatively regularly by the Turks, so who are also our allies. So this bipolar approach is not only currently ineffective, but it's going to prove ineffective. And again, we risk losing the region to the Russians, because once ISIS is driven out of Syria, what's ultimately to stop the Russians extending a hand to the Iraqi government if we can't prove to be effective against ISIS?
Has the United States benefited from the invasion of Iraq or from the whole policy in that region since 2003?
Not as such. I mean, certainly Saddam wasn't a nice guy. Saddam was a tyrant. He was a mass murderer. I'm not going to beat about the bush about that. But hindsight being 2020, the region hasn't become any more stable. The region's become a lot more instable. And fundamentally, the region needs dictators in order to maintain stability. That's just been the way the region is. Because let's face it also, a lot of these countries are artificially made. So you have peoples who normally wouldn't like each other all living in the same region. But that having been said, I think a lot of the damage was done immediately following the invasion of Iraq, when we really failed to implement a successful transition plan. Because unlike, let's say, in Nazi Germany, where at the end of World War II, we said to most of the judicial administration in Nazi Germany, most of the judges and lawyers, we said, hey, listen, you were all Nazis, that's fine, you keep your jobs. We said to all the policemen, hey, you guys keep your jobs, that's fine, we don't care. We said to the guy who ran the Department of Light and Power in Munich, hey, you keep your job, you were a member of the Nazi Party, who cares? And we tried the top war criminals, but most civil servants kept their jobs. What we did in Iraq, which made absolutely no sense, was we fired anybody who had been a member of the Ba'ath Party, and let's not forget, if you were a Sunni, you pretty much had to be a member of the Ba'ath Party. We had them all removed from government. Police officers, soldiers, administrators, bureaucrats, civil servants were all canned. And then we brought in all these Shiites who, you know, I'm sure they were wonderful people, but none of them had ever been in government before. And then the thing goes completely downhill from there. So that really was where our first major failure in Iraq occurred. And then following that, of course, the fact that we withdrew without ensuring some kind of security. You know, we really didn't have a security agreement with the Iraqis. It was sort of, you know, just a desperation just to get out of the country. And then as ISIS emerged because of our intervention in Syria. So realistically speaking, Iraq would have probably just remained a banana republic, like many dictatorships in the Middle East, had we never involved ourselves in Syria. So when you ask about the invasion of Iraq, what really set the Middle East on this spiral downwards was not the 2003 invasion, but was our intervention in Syria and our intervention in Libya. The invasion of Iraq was probably miscalculated, but what really set the Middle East on this spiral into utter chaos was our invasion of Libya, our support for the jihadists in Libya against Muammar Gaddafi, and our invasion, well, not our invasion, but our support in Syria for jihadists, militant jihadists, and al-Qaeda affiliates. And then we wonder why the entire region's gone up in smoke. And so that's really where I see the issue being.
You're listening to the In Context Report on WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott, our military affairs commentator. And we've been talking most recently about the situation in Syria and Iraq. In today's program, we're going to focus on fascism. What are its origins? What are its principal tenets? And how is it developed in different countries? Marchand, a discussion of fascism has to begin with Benito Mussolini, who founded the first fascist movement in Italy and led the country for 20 years. Marchand, please tell us, who was Benito Mussolini and how did he come to fascism?
Mussolini was born in 1883 in Italy, and he was the son of a school teacher. And his father was an avid socialist. In fact, actually, Benito Mussolini was named Benito after Benito Juarez, the famous Mexican patriot. He grew up in a very politically active environment, a very left-wing environment, but a very politically active one. You know, his father being more or less a part-time revolutionary. The young Benito was known as a bit of a troublemaker in school. He was known for getting into fights a lot. He was kind of a bit of a tough kid. As he got older, though, he maintained his sort of very much left-wing ideals. He became a journalist, actually, with a socialist newspaper, and he was very anti-war. He was opposed to, initially, Italian intervention in Western European affairs. The newspaper was called Popolo d'Italia. Mussolini maintained this sort of left-wing revolutionary spirit, if you will, up until the outbreak of World War I. And that's really when we see the fascist Mussolini begin to emerge. Is 1914, war breaks out in Europe, Italy ends up entering in on the side of the Allied powers against the Central powers. And Italy saw some very intense fighting in the Alps against the Austro-Hungarians. And Mussolini, who had been anti-war prior to the outbreak of World War I, volunteered for the Italian army. He was actually wounded by a mortar round while in his position. And he had said that that was the greatest badge of honor he could ever hope to obtain, was being wounded in combat. The war in the Alps defined Mussolini because it was very intense fighting. He wasn't a armchair soldier. He was on the front lines. And this really shaped his attitude because he's wounded, comes back to Italy, the war ends, and Italy is given nothing at the Treaty of Versailles. The other Allied powers all get something. And the British and the French, for the most part, get the Middle East, which is full of natural resources. Everybody gets a slice of the pie except Italy. Mussolini comes back, he sees the humiliation of the Italian nation, and then he sees all these unemployed soldiers. All of these soldiers coming back from the front, they now have no jobs, Italy is disgraced, Italy is now impoverished because it spent so much money fighting this war and achieved nothing. This leads to the rise of two revolutionary movements. Based on the support of the peasantry, the impoverished peasantry are the socialists. This is a time of massive socialist revolution worldwide. Let's not forget that you had the Russian Revolution of 1917, which toppled the Tsar's regime in Russia and brought Russia out of World War I. And you had the rise of the Comintern, which now was inspiring revolutionary movements all across Europe. On the other hand, you had another movement, which was based in the veterans and the urban intellectual, and, believe it or not, had strong support from Italy's Jews. It was the fascist movement, militantly nationalist, militantly anti-communist, and very militaristic. And it attracted the middle class, who were afraid that if the communists come to power, I'm going to lose my home, I'm going to lose my business, I'm going to lose everything because the communists are going to take everything. It attracted the religious because they knew the communists were avowed atheists. And then it attracted Italy's Jewish population because the Jews, who had only recently been emancipated, were determined to show their devotion to Italy, so they were attracted to the nationalist movement. And let's not forget that the nationalist movement in Italy was not anti-Semitic. Benito Mussolini was not anti-Semitic, and neither was the movement. The movement was first and foremost an Italian nationalist movement based in the veterans.
And Marchand, in the same year that he reformed the fascist party into the National Fascist Party, and Mussolini was elected himself to the Chamber of Deputies, an associate of Mussolini's, Dino Grandi, formed the Black Shirts. Could you talk about the role of the Black Shirts in the rise of the fascist party?
I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with Hitler's brown shirts. Well, Hitler's brown shirts were inspired by Mussolini's black shirts. Impoverished veterans, the disenfranchised veterans, they made up the majority of Mussolini's black shirts, also known as squadrizi. They were the muscle. The communists were engaging in street battles with the fascists. The response of the fascists was to have an armed militia, the black shirts. And they would go and they'd raid left-wing businesses and they'd fight street battles with the communists and the socialists and occasionally bump off somebody who opposed them. they were the average angry veteran who had seen Italy's disgrace, who had lost everything because of the war, and now was making a stand against communism. So that was made him ripe for picking up by the fascists, and certainly ideal for the black shirts, because it brought something that the communists didn't have, which was a military muscle as opposed to just some angry youths.
Marshawn, talk about the 1922 March on Rome, which involved 30,000 black shirts.
The March on Rome is both a propaganda piece meant to sort of emulate the march on the Winter Palace in Russia. It's supposed to be this mass demonstration of the people, this mass demonstration of outpouring of support for the fascists, which it actually was, because there were a tremendous amount of veterans, a tremendous amount of, you know, the middle class, the landowners. All these people, as you mentioned, 30,000 came out, supported the fascists, and marched in Rome. It was a spontaneous movement, but then again, it wasn't. Mussolini, he knew that the king was going to back down, and he knew the Italian parliament was going to back down. He had already made the arrangements in Rome. Mussolini was very, very clever in that he knew the significance, because he could have just secured his support and driven up to Rome, but by bringing in 30,000 black shirts, it was a way of saying, I have the popular mandate of the people. At the same time, by securing the reluctant support of the king in parliament, he also knew that this meant there wasn't the risk that they were going to be challenged and there'd be some massive incident. He wanted to show that he represented the will of the people of Italy.
The king appointed Mussolini as the prime minister. Soon thereafter, the deputies voted him dictatorial powers for 1 year. And then in 1924, the fascists led a coalition that actually won 64% of the vote and thereby consolidated power. Although the election, it should be noted, was characterized by violence, and one of the prominent socialist deputies was murdered. So Mussolini is in solid control of the country by the middle 1920s. He was not only a political leader, but he was also a political theoretician. And he wrote out the philosophy of fascism along with the philosopher Giovanni Gentile. It was called The Doctrine of Fascism. It was published in 1932. Can you talk about the theoretical basis for fascism?
The fundamental ideal of fascism is it is authoritarian and it is nationalist. And in a time of national crisis, people are willing to accept authoritarianism for security and for strength. And that's what fascism really embodies, because fascism focuses very heavily on militarism, on expansion, on restoring national pride, national dignity, as I mentioned, rebuilding the armed forces. It takes on different forms in every country it's in, but particularly in Italian fascism, where the birth occurred, it focused on a Roman revival. That's why they reintroduced the Roman salute and everything. That's why restoring Roman sections of Rome, I mean, you know, areas of Rome that dated back to the time of the ancient Romans, restoring those, bringing back traditional Italy. And the other important tenet is the idea of the nation, the idea that the nation is above all else. Now, in communism, it's the party and the state. And in Italian fascism, it's the nation.
He says that outside of the nation state, no human or spiritual values exist. The state's control extends to all economic, political, and social institutions. It's somewhat different from your ordinary dictatorship where one strong man takes power. This is a theory that says we are going to get into every aspect of society and we're going to control it and make sure that it bends to the national purpose.
An important difference between communism and fascism is that fascism does not necessarily, while it subordinates the individual to the nation and to the fascist state, it does not make the individual a cog. And that's one of the important distinctions with communism, is communism makes the individual a cog. The communism completely eliminates the individual. Fascism says you are an individual, but you must work towards the benefit of the state.
Another important distinction is that communism is based on class conflict, whereas the fascist ideology says all social classes are involved. We're essentially unified under the national banner.
Mussolini created the idea of trade guilds, the idea that you would have an entity that would arbitrate on behalf of the employer and on behalf of the employee, as opposed to the traditional trade unions. The reason for this is because workers still needed some kind of representation, but as opposed to the communist system, which like you said, thrived off a class struggle and said, take what is belongs to those above you, the fascists said, no, everybody's entitled to what they have, but you just do not cheat those above you and do not cheat those below you was basically the moral, and that's why it held such appeal with the middle class, especially because the middle class feared the communists, because the communists would come in and say, you do not own your business.
Private enterprise coexists with fascism nicely. In fact, private enterprise is viewed by the fascists as the most effective instrument to advance the interests of the nation. However, the state has a right to intervene in the economy to direct private businesses for the national good.
That was one of the reasons why they were able to bring in the working class, because they showed the working class that we will keep the fat cats in check. And that helped undermine the communists, because the whole principle of the communists was topple the fat cats. Well, the fascists came and said, you don't have to topple them. We'll keep them in check. And then they told the guys at the top, the businessmen, and said, listen, don't worry. We'll keep the working class in check. And so fascism worked off of keeping a really what was a capitalist balance between the business bosses on the one hand and the workers on the other.
Turning to foreign policy, Mussolini wrote, fascism repudiates the doctrine of pacifism. War alone brings up to its highest tension all human energy and puts the stamp of nobility upon the peoples who have the courage to meet it. What was his attitude towards the military then?
He viewed Italian society in the Roman ideal, the idea that the military is supreme, that the greatest glory anyone could seek to obtain is military glory, glory on the battlefield. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, he was a soldier himself. So he elevated the role of the military in society tremendously. He also viewed the military as a unifying tool in Italy. In addition to that, he also realized that the state, the nation, exists because of the military. Without the military, the state has no muscle. Without the military, the state is impotent. Without the military, the state can no longer protect the nation nor enforce its own laws. And then he also realized the military as the tool for restoring the Roman Empire.
Yes, Marchand, he was very focused on restoring the Roman Empire, and in 1935, he invaded and conquered Ethiopia, creating an Italian East Africa, which was really intended to become the beginning of a larger Italian empire. How successful were his efforts at building an Italian empire in the 1930s?
Where Mussolini was a very intelligent politician and a brilliant political philosopher, he was not in any way, shape, or form a brilliant military commander. The Italian army was really not ready for combat. It really was not combat capable because it was still reeling from the victory in the First World War. You say reeling from victory, it's a weird concept, but Italy was impoverished, and so too was its military. And so when Italy moved to invade Ethiopia, they subdued the Ethiopians, but they had a very hard time. Mussolini ended up resorting to the use of chemical weapons in order to try to break the Ethiopian resistance. And let's not forget, the Ethiopian military was far from a first world military. The problem is Mussolini's army was very poorly equipped and in many cases very poorly led. This also led to issues Mussolini had when he invaded Albania, when he invaded Libya, and issues he had in fighting in Somalia, and issues later on during the war fighting in Greece.
Greece was really his downfall, wasn't it? I mean, he managed to conquer Ethiopia, but in 1940, the invasion of Greece, following his invasion of Albania, it turned out to be a real disaster. And then subsequently, he invaded Egypt from Libya, and that was another costly failure. It was just really what led eventually to his downfall, and which is, of course, interesting because there's no question he ran a one-party state. He had everything going for him. He created a secret police. He outlawed rival parties. He abolished parliamentary elections. He unashamedly used violence to intimidate his opponents. But ultimately, it was his defeats in war that really led to his downfall in 1943 when there were massive labor unrests in Italy. And then, of course, in World War II, Italy was attacked by the Allies and Rome was bombed. So he certainly was presiding over a disaster that people didn't want anymore. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marchand McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking about the rise of fascism in Italy and the basic tenets of fascism. Now, Marchand, let's turn to the man who followed and then eclipsed Mussolini, Adolf Hitler, who ruled Germany from 1933 to 1945. Marchand, can you talk about the similarities between Hitler and Mussolini?
They were both men shaped by World War I. Mussolini shaped by his service fighting in the Alps, and Hitler shaped by his services on the Western Front. Both men had been wounded in World War I. Hitler blinded in a gas attack, and Mussolini injured by a shrapnel. We see that this is the defining moment for both men. Both men probably would have disappeared into obscurity had it not been for the First World War. What's very interesting, though, is where we look at their influences post-World War I, and this is where we start to see a divergence. Mussolini turns towards fascism, but in more traditional nationalism. Hitler becomes influenced at this point by members of the Thule Society, which is a militant nationalist movement, but also a Aryan supremacist movement. And that's where we begin to see these qualities that become unique to Hitler and unique to Nazism emerge with Hitler and not with Mussolini. Though, again, we do see the similarities. They both become involved in nationalist movements. Hitler becomes involved with the National Socialist German Workers' Party, Mussolini with the Italian Fascist Party. Unlike Mussolini, Hitler became involved not initially because he was a revolutionary, but because he was a spy for German intelligence. German intelligence sent Hitler to go spy on the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which at the time was just sort of a militantly nationalist revolutionary party, but it was small and obscure. And Hitler found he actually took a liking to it. The party appealed to his newfound nationalism. It also appealed to his newfound anti-Semitism. He also found that he had a knack for public speaking. He went from becoming an informant to a rabble-rouser to an organizer. Very rapidly with Hitler, see this rocketing from low-level informant. He now wants to emulate Mussolini's March on Rome. And he decides that he is going to hold a putsch, what became known as the Beer Hall Putsch in Munich. And he decided he was going to eventually lead a march on Berlin, the same way Mussolini led a march on Rome.
This was in 1923, only 1 year after Mussolini's march on Rome.
Hitler had not, politically speaking, become as savvy as Mussolini was at this stage, in that Mussolini had, in addition to the fact that his march was very popular and he had the popular support, he'd already knew that he was going to make it. He'd already secured the route. He already secured the king and parliament. He knew he was going to make it to Rome. Whereas the problem is Hitler actually believed that this was going to be a spontaneous revolution, and instead he ended up getting ambushed by the German armed forces and arrested.
Among the similarities between the two is that they both used paramilitary units to intimidate their opponents, and they both initially achieved power through an election. And then again, both of them quickly moved to establish a dictatorship and an authoritarian regime.
Hitler was very inspired by Mussolini's black shirts and the effectiveness of the black shirts, so he implemented his own paramilitary wing, the brown shirts. They were made up largely, at least in the beginning, of veterans from the First World War who had been disenfranchised, who had been felt humiliated by the defeat in the First World War, who were now unemployed, and they made up the muscle of the brown shirts. The other thing that's important to remember as well is the conditions in Germany were the same as Italy, and I should go back to that. Germans were at the time running street battles going, just like in Italy prior, between the communists and fascists and right-wing militias and whatnot. Unlike in Italy, though, in Germany there were full-blown, I mean, when I say battles, we're not talking about just gangs of thugs fighting each other. Machine guns were brought out onto the streets by these very various militias. Before Hitler's election, the brown shirts almost came to rival the German army in terms of size, in terms of organization. They were very well armed. Then, of course, is one of the things that helped secure Hitler's election in Germany. There was voter intimidation, and the brown shirts helped ensure that certain people didn't vote. We see the same conditions. We see the same methods being implemented on both sides.
We see also that the concern for the economy, the private economy, was allowed to exist, but it was directed by the state to serve national goals. And like Mussolini, Hitler embarked on major construction projects to put people to work.
While Mussolini built roads and restored a lot of this Roman architecture, Hitler built the Autobahn, and he put hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions of Germans back to work. He ensured the factories were opened up again. He worked very well with big business. And oddly enough, he worked very closely with none other than Henry Ford. Henry Ford was a great admirer of Adolf Hitler because Hitler was very good for business. It is capitalism with a nationalist bent. So as long as you were willing to work towards the national good, you can make as much money as you wanted, but just you were going to work towards building roads or building tanks or building planes or something that was going to glorify the nation.
You'd mentioned that Mussolini's attitude towards the Jews was not the same as Hitler's. In fact, in the early Nazi program statement of 1920, the Nazis stated the Jews, in fact, were not part of the German race and could not be citizens.
Italian fascism was not racist. It was not anti-Semitic. They had a tremendous amount of support from Italian Jews, and Mussolini numerous times had spoken of the fact that the nation is united. All peoples are united in love of the nation. Nazism took on a uniquely anti-Semitic twist. Now, a lot of this was because Europe, especially at the time, was rife with anti-Semitism, and particularly in Germany, following the defeat in World War I and the rise of communists, it did not help that Trotsky and Kamenev and Zinoviev were Jews. Many of the leading communists in the Soviet Union were Jews, and a lot of the prominent socialists were Jews, and that played into the hands of the Nazis. The Nazis used that in order to push their anti-Semitic agenda initially, but then it grew to expand not just to Jews, but to Gypsies, to people of Asiatic descent. If you were part Polish, if you were part Czech, if you were not 100% Aryan, if you were not blonde hair and blue eyed, you were not a true German.
Marchand, an important policy that they shared, Mussolini and Hitler, was the idea of imperialism, the idea that their nation needed living space, which then required them to conquer other countries. And in both cases, it brought them down. Mussolini in 1943, when his government collapsed under the weight of his military disasters and the Allied invasion of Italy. And then, of course, in 1945, when Hitler was brought down, as he was invaded by Russia on the east and the United States and its allies from the west.
We do see, again, in both men, a lack of military understanding, which is often what led them to overstretch themselves. Again, Mussolini had only been an enlisted soldier, and Hitler himself had only been a corporal. So these men, they had a military background, but they did not have a wider military background. They did not understand when their generals were telling them this is a bad idea, we are overstretched, or, you know, our divisions need more supplies, or it was something that they really didn't understand. Hitler so quickly overstretched himself in spite of his generals telling him it's not a good idea to invade Russia right now. We still haven't secured the Western Front.
Another fascist leader, Francisco Franco of Spain, stayed out of World War II. Could you talk about Spain's Franco?
We see the similar conditions in Spain that we saw in Italy, that we saw in Germany, the rising communist movement, tremendous amount of poverty. Spain really hadn't industrialized. It wasn't one communist movement. It was a coalition. They called themselves the Republicans, but they were socialists. They were communists. They were anarchists. There were social democrats. The idea was that they were going to topple the monarchy and they were going to bring about a workers' coalition. But in the 1930s, this turned violent. In response to that, you had the Falangists, who were the Spanish fascists, and around them rallied another coalition, a coalition of royalists, Carlists, the church, as well as several other right-wing movements. Franco emerged as the leader of what became more or less the fascist coalition. Part of it was because he was a general. He was also very pragmatic. He knew that one of the things that separated Spanish fascists from Spanish Republicans was the fact that the Spanish fascists were not anti-Catholic. The Republicans, part of their goal was to abolish the church, and they were notorious for shooting priests and shooting nuns and shooting monks and blowing up churches. Franco emerges not only as the military savior, the man who can possibly militarily save Spain from the communists, but also as the defender of the faith. And he accepted help from Hitler and Mussolini to help fight against the communists.
Thousands of Italian soldiers fought in Spain for Franco's side during the Spanish Civil War. And it's interesting that once he won, he united these royalists and the right-wingers in a single totalitarian state and ruled in much the way of Hitler and Mussolini, styled himself El Caudillo, the chief, similar to the Führer for Hitler, or Il Duce for Mussolini, and he adopted the same harsh tactics. He executed hundreds of thousands of opponents and established concentration camps. But as you pointed out, he was different from them with respect to one crucial issue, and that was getting involved in World War II.
Franco was very intelligent that he accepted all this help, but at the same time, he knew to stay out of World War II, and that's where we see him as a military man. He knew that Spain was not ready for war. Spain had just been reeling from the, was a very bloody civil war. Staying out of World War II benefited him because he remained in power up until his death.
He ruled from 1939 to 1975, and as you say, staying out of World War II was, for terms of his regime's longevity, was extremely useful. And it's interesting, as we contrast Franco with Hitler and with Mussolini, he did provide for a peaceful transition back to a democratic monarchy. And this is pretty astounding when you consider that fascism under Mussolini and Hitler was intended to be permanent. It was an institution of total state control. So I think while Franco was a fascist, he saw himself as a fascist, he did let go towards the end of his life and allow for a transition back to a modern democratic Spain that we see.
Fascism takes on the unique qualities of the country it's in. It's the same thing with communism. Communism takes on the unique qualities of the country it's in. Russian Soviet communism bears no resemblance to Chinese Maoism or to North Korean Juche, which also bear no relationship to socialism in Norway. Fascism is much the same way, and I think you have to go into the unique qualities of the country and the motivations of the individual in question. Unlike Hitler and unlike Mussolini, Franco was not interested in creating an empire. He was interested in keeping the communists out and creating a strong Spain, but he did not equate that with needing an empire.
Marchand, I'm afraid we're coming to the end of the show, but before we close, I wonder if you'd give us your thoughts as to what are the circumstances that bring fascists to power?
Well, absolutely. The first thing I think you have to see is a loss of national pride, because that really precedes everything else, is humiliation. Whether it's being humiliated in a war, such as Germany was at the end of World War I, or being humiliated internationally, such as Italy was at the end of World War I, as we were seeing with Britain at the end of World War I, the slow eroding of their economy and the slow eroding of their empire, which led to the rise of the British Union of Fascists. National humiliation is followed quickly on the heels by economic hardships, the downturn in the economy, the fact that people now find themselves hard up for jobs. We see similar conditions existing in the United States now, the fact that the economy is hurting, there is a sense of national humiliation. This was the same thing that occurred in Germany at the end of World War I, it occurred in Italy, and certainly occurred in Spain as well. And then a feeling of failure in democracy. Now, one of the things that in the United States we're blessed in is that we still have hope in our democracy. But in countries like Italy and Spain and Germany, they had lost hope in their democracy. There was a feeling that the politicians were these ineffectual bureaucrats who not only were incapable of restoring national dignity, but they'd also become too comfortable as politicians. They'd become a career. They were making a living as politicians. It was no longer about the national pride, so they lost faith in democracy. And that's what also leads to the rise of a right-wing charismatic leader. And that's the final quality you have to have. So you first have to have national humiliation, a bad economy, a feeling that democracy has failed, and then finally you have somebody who can exploit that. And that's a Mussolini, that's a Hitler, that's a Franco, somebody who can step into the gap. Because now the people are crying with that failure in democracy. They're crying, we want somebody to save the nation, save the economy. Our politicians have failed us. And especially when that person does not come from a political background, it is essential. Because if you look at Hitler was not a politician, Mussolini was not a politician, Franco was not a politician, and that's what appealed to people. This was the alternative, the real alternative. This wasn't more or less the same. This wasn't, you know, the social democrats or the socialists or the, you know, liberal democrats. This was somebody different. This was an unknown quantity, but this stage, in a moment of desperation, people wanted something to believe in.
Well, that's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1. You can stream or download the War Report from our website, incontextreport.com, or from WPKN.org by clicking on Podcasts in the upper left-hand corner. Watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.